Many seem only to know Schopenhauer for his pessimism. And if you're unfamiliar, here's a taste of his cheery outlook. We can regard our life as a uselessly disturbing episode in the blissful repose of nothingness. End quote. I'm not all that interested in how Schopenhauer thinks we should live. His biography is fascinating, though. Quote, when German philosophers were entrenched in the universities and immersed in the theological concerns of their time, Schopenhauer was an atheist who stayed outside the academic profession. Schopenhauer's lack of recognition during most of his lifetime may have been due to the iconoclasm of his thought, but it was probably also partly due to his irascible and stubborn temperament. End quote. Mary Troxell of Boston College. Here's what Schopenhauer's mother, Joanna Schopenhauer, had to say about his irascible and stubborn temperament in a letter to her son when he was 19 years old. Quote, I am acquainted with your heart and know that few are better, but you are nevertheless irritating and unbearable, and I consider it most difficult to live with you. All of your good qualities become obscured by your super cleverness and are made useless to the world merely because of your rage at wanting to know everything better than others, of wanting to improve and master what you cannot command. With this, you embitter the people around you, since no one wants to be improved or enlightened in such a forceful way, least of all by such an insignificant individual as you still are. No one can tolerate being reproved by you, who also still show so many weaknesses yourself, least of all in your adverse manner, which, in oracular tones, proclaims this is so-and-so, without ever supposing an objection. If you were less like you, you would only be ridiculous, but thus as you are highly annoying. End quote. And that was his own mother. He would go on to shove a different woman he didn't like down the stairs, probably in an attempt to murder her. She successfully sued for damages, and when she eventually passed away, he wrote in his journal, "The old woman dies, the burden is lifted." So, while I'm not all that interested in his advice on how one ought to live, his metaphysical work on consciousness is invaluable, and somehow still relevant 2 centuries later. In 1818, he published the first edition of The World as Will and Representation. Should you ever read it, the greatly expanded 3rd edition, published in 1859, is the one you'd want. Quote, the act of the will and the action of the body are not 2 different states objectively known, connected by the bond of causality, but are one and the same thing, though given in 2 entirely different ways, first quite directly, and then in perception for the understanding. The action of the body is nothing but the act of the will objectified, in other words, translated into perception. The whole body is nothing but the objectified will. In other words, will that has become representation. The will is knowledge a priori of the body, and the body is knowledge a posteriori of the will. End quote. According to Schopenhauer, everything in itself is will, but we only apprehend will directly in our own case. I'm a subject in a world of objects. Everything else I perceive, beyond my own subjective experience, is a representation. It's only in our own case, as a unified whole, that we have this knowledge of both aspects. We represent our will as behavior. We represent the subjective as the objective. For others, this knowledge of both aspects is impossible. Consciousness is unobservable from a third-person perspective. For Schopenhauer, we represent the minds of others as behavior, just as they represent our subjective minds as objective behavior. We merely infer the experience of others. We don't experience the will of others in the same way we apprehend our own. Thomas Nagel expressed this view succinctly in Mind and Cosmos, quote, we ourselves are large-scale, complex instances of something both objectively physical from outside and subjectively mental from inside. Perhaps the basis for this identity pervades the world. End quote. It should be noted that mind and body, or will and representation, don't interact with each other causally. They're 2 sides of the same coin. This view is sometimes called dual aspect monism or double aspect theory, ontological monism, and epistemological dualism. That's key, I think, to understanding Schopenhauer's metaphysics. Bernardo Kastrup, metaphysical idealist and author of Decoding Schopenhauer's Metaphysics, strongly objects to the characterization of Schopenhauer as a dual aspect monist. Listening to Kastrup, however, I'm not sure if we have a different understanding of dual aspect monism, Schopenhauer's metaphysics, or both. Philosopher Peter Schursted H. identifies Schopenhauer as a proponent of dual aspect theory, as does Mary Troxell, as does Hedda Hassel-Merck, as does Robert Wicks, the author of the Schopenhauer entry in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. I'm fine with calling Schopenhauer a dual aspect monist because that seems to be the most natural interpretation of his views, and Kastrup is the only person I'm aware of who strongly disagrees. So while I think Schopenhauer can be fairly placed as a dual aspect monist, and so do many experts on Schopenhauer, I think it should be noted that scholars disagree. Again, I think there may be a disconnect over the exact nature of dual aspect monism. There are different interpretations of the view that vary widely, and the philosophical discussion over the nature of double aspect theories, neutral monism, and panpsychism is open-ended. This is not anything like a settled area where there are clear right and wrong answers about how these labels should be applied. So I think it'd be a good idea not to get too hung up on terminology and simply explain the substance of the view in question. So let's return to that passage from Schopenhauer's magnum opus, The World as Will and Representation. Quote, "The act of the will and the action of the body are not two different states objectively known, connected by the bond of causality, but are one and the same thing, though given in entirely different ways, first quite directly, and then in perception for the understanding. The action of the body is nothing but the act of will objectified, in other words, translated into perception. The whole body is nothing but the objectified will, in other words, will that has become representation. The will is knowledge a priori of the body, and the body is knowledge a posteriori of the will. We have immediate cognition of the thing in itself when it appears to us as our own body, but our cognition is only indirect when the thing in itself is objectified in other objects of intuition." End quote. We all have a direct experience with which we're immediately acquainted, and our representation of the external world appears in this experience. In the mind-body dichotomy, we experience all bodies as mere appearance, representation. We have an experience of willing our hand to close into a fist, and we can look down and observe our fist closing. It's only in our own case that we experience both aspects of the world and represent our felt will as behavior. Quote, "To the pure subject of cognition as such, his body is a representation like any other among objects. But will, in this alone, gives him the key to his own appearance, reveals to him the meaning, and shows him the inner workings of his essence, his deeds, his movements." End quote. This is a feature of Schopenhauer's philosophy that distinguishes him from other idealists of his time. To Schopenhauer, desire-driven will is what we are from inside, and he goes on to argue that we should think of the underlying reality of all appearance in the same way. You represent my will as a body, but I know that there's an underlying reality to your representation that's experiential in character. Schopenhauer thinks the basis of this dual aspect character of reality pervades the natural world, organic and inorganic. Why? To quote the Stanford Encyclopedia, "Because this is our only form of insight into, or acquaintance with, anything as a thing in itself." End quote. Since will in itself is unobservable from a third-person perspective, he derives his conclusion not from empirical observation, that would be impossible, but rather from our immediate acquaintance with the character of our own wills, as well as a hard-nosed monism, the view that at bottom, everything is essentially one. Ultimate reality, says Schopenhauer, is everywhere one and the same, must be called will, here as well as there, a name signifying the being in itself of everything in the world and the sole kernel of every appearance. End quote. As Philip Goff explains, quote, "Schopenhauer was influenced by Kant's view that we lack an understanding of reality as it is in and of itself, but he made a crucial exemption for the immediate knowledge one has of oneself. taking will to be the fundamental quality one is aware of in introspection, Schopenhauer thus theorized that will is the inner nature of all things. This line of reasoning bears a striking similarity to, and indeed is an important influence on, the contemporary Russellian monists. End quote. So, was Schopenhauer an idealist, or was he a panpsychist? Yes. For Schopenhauer, the world is all appearance to us. We don't have some kind of objective pipeline to reality hooked up to our brains. All we have is a representation. So that's essentially why he's an idealist. But unlike many other idealists, he takes a stab at what underlies the appearances of reality. What is the stuff that's being represented? Modern panpsychists have claimed Schopenhauer for this reason. The will is what the physical world is in itself. There's a smooth continuum between the organic and inorganic world, all with the same inner nature. We represent will as matter and force and so on, but something analogous to the human will is behind the movements of nature, just as will is behind the movements of the physical bodies of others. Quote, "We must learn to understand nature from ourselves, not ourselves from nature." We infer that, from the inside, other people are like us. This is an inference. We don't directly apprehend their inner subjectivity like we do our own. I'm a subject in a world of objects. For human beings and many other organisms, I'm reasonably certain that there's a subjective aspect underlying those physical systems. For Schopenhauer, all of nature is like this. To all matter, there is a subjective aspect. Quote, "Consequently, a way from within stands open to us, to that real inner nature of things, to which we cannot penetrate from without. It is, so to speak, a subterranean passage, a secret alliance, which, as if by treachery, places us all at once in the fortress that could not be taken by attack from without." According to philosopher Hedda Hasselmerck, this approach is a bit more in line with how panpsychism was defended in the past. Quote, "Historically, panpsychism has been defended by appeal to an argument based on considerations about the nature and observability of causation." End quote. She's developed an argument for panpsychism from the experience of causation, wherein our direct experience of causation is a paradigmatic example of causation generally. This line of reasoning goes back many centuries, and Merck has a lot of interesting writing bringing that traditional argument into the modern debate. Quote, "The argument from causation can be understood as having the following general form. 1. All physical things have causal powers. 2. The only causal powers whose nature we can know, or positively conceive of, are mental. 3. The nature of the causal powers of physical things is knowable, or positively conceivable. Therefore, all physical things have mental properties." End quote. And here's William James making a version of the argument. "The concrete perpetual flux, taken just as it comes, offers perfectly comprehensible instances of causal agency. If we took these experiences as the type of what actual causation is, we should have to ascribe to cases of causation outside of our life, to physical cases also, an inwardly experiential nature. In other words, we should have to espouse a so-called panpsychic philosophy." End quote. Proponents of this route to panpsychism include Leibniz, Whitehead, and Schopenhauer. As Merck puts it, Schopenhauer held a dual-aspect panpsychist view, according to which from the outside, the world appears as representation, but from the inside, it appears as will. Like Leibniz, Schopenhauer holds that all things must have causal powers. Furthermore, the only way to understand these powers or forces is by analogy with our own power to act. End quote. So for Schopenhauer, all causation is mental causation. Our direct experience of mental causation, or will, underlying the movement of our physical bodies, is not a bizarre divergence from the rest of the natural world. And we do have to be careful using the word causation, since he takes causation to be a feature of our representational apparatus. The point being, the movement we observe in the organic and inorganic world is all driven by the same underlying reality. As Schopenhauer explains, only from a comparison with what goes on within me when my body performs an action from a motive that moves me, can I obtain an insight into the way in which those inanimate bodies change under the influence of causes, and thus understand what is their inner nature. From the law of motivation, I must learn to understand the law of causality and its inner significance. Spinoza says that if a stone projected through the air had consciousness, it would imagine it was flying of its own will. I would add merely that the stone would be right. End quote. We've been talking about will, but we should mention that free will, as it's ordinarily conceived, has nothing to do with Schopenhauer's metaphysics. A quote that's often attributed to Schopenhauer is, "Man can do what he wills, but cannot will what he wills." He also said, quote, "That undeniable assertion of self-consciousness, I can do what I will, contains and decides nothing at all about the freedom of the will." And, "Whatever occurs, necessarily occurs." End quote. So we can will things, we can act in accordance with our will, but that doesn't mean we have this totally uncaused, unconstrained, libertarian free will. A further clarification, mind and body, or will and representation, don't interact with each other causally on this view. They're two sides of the same coin. So it's not as if body is causally determining mind, or vice versa. They're two aspects of one underlying reality. The ultimate reality is will, and we represent will as material objects, or in some other mode. As Peter Schursted H. explains, quote, "Schopenhauer presents a metaphysical, ontological monism with an epistemological dualism." Materialism, said Schopenhauer, is the philosophy of the subject who forgets to take account of himself. I think this basic insight of his is crucial if we want to, quote, lay bare the true nature of the world, which is the purpose of philosophy as Schopenhauer sees it. We are not outside of the natural world, peering in. You are a physical system, and so you have some insider knowledge about the physical by virtue of being a physical system. I think a lot of philosophical confusion stems from this mistaken God's eye view philosophy in which many forget that their consciousness, their will, every thought they have, is just as much a part of nature as space-time. So while it's true that when we make contact with any concrete reality other than our own current experience, we can only ever have access to an appearance or a representation, our representation of the world is partially a product of how the world is in itself, but it's conditioned by our minds. An idealist like Kant doesn't even exempt our own current experience from this appearance-reality distinction. And that's one area in which Schopenhauer thought Kant was mistaken. Our direct experience should not be in the same category as the representations in that experience. Consider the fact that we know that we're conscious. We know what it's like to be conscious by virtue of being conscious. The having of an experience is the knowing of an experience. Consciousness knowledge is clearly distinct from knowledge of the external world. That's why Schopenhauer doesn't lump in will with representations. He takes will to be thing in itself. Quote, "On the path of objective knowledge, thus starting from the representation, we shall never get beyond the representation. We shall therefore remain at the outside of things. We shall never be able to penetrate into their inner nature and investigate what they are in themselves." So far, I agree with Kant. But we ourselves are the thing in itself. Consequently, a way from within stands open to us, to that real inner nature of things, to which we cannot penetrate from without. It is, so to speak, a subterranean passage, a secret alliance, which, as if by treachery, places us all at once in the fortress that could not be taken by attack from without. End quote. Consciousness is unobservable from a third-person perspective. It could not be taken by attack from without. Quote, "To try to know thing in itself, objectively, is to desire something contradictory. End quote. If you're familiar with Russellian monism, you'll notice many striking parallels in Schopenhauer's thought. The physical is a representation. We don't know of the concrete reality that fleshes out the structure that science tells us about. We don't know the intrinsic nature of the physical, what the physical is in itself. We only know what it does. We have no idea what it is. But we ourselves are a part of the natural world, and thus have a direct insight into the nature of matter in itself. So whether we want to call this Russellian panpsychism, or dual-aspect monism, conscious realism, or something else, I'm sort of indifferent. The important part to me is the general view that Schopenhauer and many others have expressed, albeit in different terms. Truth be told, I think people such as Galen Strawson, Donald Hoffman, Schopenhauer, and other philosophers we mentioned today are all climbing the same mountain on different sides. I'm not saying the Venn diagram of their views is a circle, but from a distance, it looks circular. I think a key point is ontological monism and epistemological dualism. However we get there, by way of Russell, or Schopenhauer, or some other side of the mountain, is fine by me. If we accept the monism of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, we can consider subjectivity as an intrinsic part of the represented world as matter. Peter Schursted H. We haven't mentioned it so far, but Schopenhauer was a major inspiration for Nietzsche. Anything like a complete understanding of Nietzsche's metaphysics requires a close study of Schopenhauer's, since so much of his work on metaphysics and psychology either built on Schopenhauer or was a response to Schopenhauer. In fact, Nietzsche's famous will to power was an example. He also thought everything was will. Nietzsche's acquaintance, Lou Salome, when writing in 1894 of, quote, Nietzsche's Theory of the Will, referred to him as, quote, a disciple of Schopenhauer, end quote. Nietzsche's doctrine of the will to power wasn't just a psychological thesis, but a broader metaphysical view. He thought everything is will to power, which is one reason philosopher Galen Strawson attributes to him the view that, quote, reality is suffused with, if it does not consist of, mentality in some form. And if you're interested, I linked a lecture and a paper on this. In fact, philosopher Peter Schursted H. was led to panpsychism by way of Nietzsche. Quote, my route to panpsychism was through Nietzsche. He emphasizes this notion of the will to power, which is ultimately a drive that underlies what we see as matter. It's not consciousness, absolutely, but it is a form of sentience, which underlies everything. End quote. This is a subject for another episode, but of course I'm happy to claim Nietzsche, just as I'm happy to claim Schopenhauer. Though the label is rarely applied to him, Schopenhauer was a panpsychist. Lest you think I'm the first person to point this out, philosophers Karl Popper, quote, Schopenhauer is a Kantian who has turned panpsychist, Hedda Hassel-Merck, Philip Goff, Benedict Gokhe, and neuroscientist Christoph Koch have all come to the same conclusion. Schopenhauer is one in a long line of mainstream, anti-physicalist Western philosophers who take nature to be suffused with, if it doesn't consist of, consciousness. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.